for we knew that the stars on our back.
When the Civil War ended in 1865, thousands of men who had fought on both sides headed west, and many settled near Puget Sound. Now, a Bothell man has devoted himself to discovering and telling the stories of the former Civil War soldiers who were laid to rest in local cemeteries. And our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, got a preview of a free tour taking place on Capitol Hill tomorrow. Felix is brought to you by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning, Felix.
Hey, good morning, Aaron. Have you ever been to the Grand Army of the Republic Cemetery on Capitol Hill?
I have not.
Yeah, it's right across the street, just to the north from that giant Lakeview Cemetery, a much more famous place where Bruce Lee and other people are buried, on the north part of the hill. Now, it dates to the 1880s. There's about 500 Union veterans of the Civil War buried there. It's been a city park for almost 100 years, but it's also been something of an orphan at times. For the past few decades, a group of neighbors has tended the grounds and worked with the Seattle Parks Department as an official friends group to raise money and to keep an eye on the place. There's one neighbor who raises and lowers the flag every day. Anyway, it's one of the most distinctive places in the city in terms of the setting and the history, and just the look and the feel, really, too. So tomorrow night, there's a local historian named Richard Heisler who's going to lead a free guided tour. He's a professional artist for his day job and a very successful one, but he spent the past 2 years doing deep research on each of the veterans buried on Capitol Hill. Now, the stories that are hidden there make that tiny patch of land pretty incredible.
And one thing that's distinct about this place and makes it special, and I think it's only comparable to the Ording Soldiers Home Cemetery or maybe the Veterans Cemetery in California where the Soldiers Home was, is the diversity. Because if you have cemeteries with more Civil War veterans, there's 500 or so here in Chicago or Cleveland or Pittsburgh, but they're going to be mostly guys from Illinois or mostly guys from Pennsylvania. Here, it's an insanely diverse grab bag. There's somebody from every single state, every single battle, every campaign of the war, every branch of service, heavy artillery, cavalry, navy, marines, infantry, light infantry, mounted infantry. It's all here.
Wow.
You know, and that's because Seattle was a magnet for people in the 19th century from all over the country, right? People were coming here and it was a relatively new community settled by people from elsewhere. Now, I got a preview of the tour with Richard Heisler a few days ago, and pretty much everywhere you turn, there's an interesting story. You literally will trip over the headstones if you're not careful. Now, the wealthy veterans are in places like Lakeview across the street, but the GAR Cemetery, the Grand Army of the Republic, which is sort of a veterans group, has its notable people too, like Tip Winchell.
Among the people of Seattle at the time, there's a guy named Topping Winchell. Tip Winchell was his nickname. He was a bailiff for the Seattle Police Court. And pre-TV and pre-radio, the stories of the happenings of the police court were tremendous entertainment in the newspaper. So it was like a daily column, week, you know, a big deal. And Tip was apparently an enormous personality. Super bigger, like just bigger than life guy. And when he passed away, it was kind of a big deal. That was the biggest funeral to ever take place in here because he was kind of a beloved figure for the people of Seattle.
Yeah, and there's not much in the way of any photos of any funerals that ever took place there. And most of the things that happened were pretty small time, but this Tip Winchell funeral was huge, hundreds of people.
Wow.
Now, Richard Heisler does have a bit of a personal connection to one of the soldiers buried at the GAR Cemetery. His third great-grandfather was in the 97th New York Infantry, and so was a guy named Justice Rockwell. They were both wounded at Fredericksburg in 1862, within maybe 100 yards of each other. Both went to the same hospital. Now, it turns out that Justice Rockwell, whose grave is there on Capitol Hill and has been there for more than 100 years, was a pretty famous songwriter. He actually wrote that music we heard a few minutes ago.
He wrote a super, super famous song of the Civil War called Sherman's March to the Sea. He was a musician before the war. So he has a really captivating story about how that song was written in Columbia, South Carolina, in the prison pen on Christmas Day of 1864 when they got the news that Sherman had reached Augusta from marching, you know, the march to the sea had concluded. They had no idea in this prison. And one of the black men who was working as a baker to make bread for the prisoners who were pretty much starving as it was, he wrote it on a piece of paper and he folded it up. They said less than the size of a thimble, put it in the loaf of bread, sent the loaf of bread into the prison. They got the news. The place went crazy. He, as a musician, wrote this song. Another musician wrote, or he was more of a poet, I guess, wrote the lyrics to the song. They performed it for the first time Christmas morning, 1864.
Yeah, and if that wasn't enough of a story, they also smuggled the sheet music out of the prison in a fellow prisoner's hollow artificial leg.
No.
And the song was published and sold millions of copies, but Justice Rockwell didn't see a penny of it because he was in prison.
Mm.
So Richard Heiser's been doing tons of research about the Union soldiers buried there. We also had Confederates in Seattle as well. Heiser says that the relationship between the two groups of veterans, Confederates and Union soldiers, was different here in the Northwest than it would have been back in, say, Tennessee or Virginia. The Northwest was more recently settled, so there was just a different dynamic.
The general consensus was, like, we're not going to fight the war anymore. And you really see it in the Spanish-American War and World War I. They're all vocal. The Confederates in particular in Seattle are super vocal about, we're fighting under one flag now. Our sons and grandsons are fighting under the Stars and Stripes, and the Confederacy is, it is what it is. We still believe we were right, but that's in the past. The Seattle Confederates really, really hold to that idea.
So this tour is tomorrow night at 7 o'clock on Capitol Hill. We have all the information at mynorthwest.com. Richard Heiser is one of these guys who I love to meet, who's just deeply passionate about a topic. He goes, spends us all the research, finds all these incredible stories, and then I'm able to share them on the radio like this. And so it's a great chance to get out. It's outdoors. You know, you can be socially distanced. It's a perfect thing to do in the late stages of a pandemic, to visit a cemetery where there's just all these great hidden stories.
Felix, I'm blown away. This is fascinating. It was right under my nose. I used to live blocks from there and didn't even know that the cemetery existed.
Yeah, they don't do a lot to promote it because it's a city park. Most veterans are buried in federal facilities or facilities that have some kind of a mandate and have sort of a money to support them into the future. This thing is dependent on the goodwill of those neighbors and the Seattle Parks Department keeping an eye on it. And it's just hundreds and hundreds of people with hundreds and hundreds of fascinating stories.
Yeah, that's incredible. Again, tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at the Grand Army of the Republic Cemetery.
It's all free and no pre-registration required. Just be nice if you park somewhere. Don't park in front of someone's driveway.
Perfect. Thank you so much, historian Felix Bunnell. Great story, Felix. Thank you.
Thanks.
Safety issues in and around the King County Courthouse have gotten so bad, there's a multi-million-dollar homeless outreach effort in the works, and the sheriff has ordered office staff back to remote working. Now a King County council member wants to take things a step further. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott joins us live with the details. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron. Yeah, those crime and safety issues in and around the aging courthouse are nothing new. Many believe that danger level, though, has now gone up.
A lot of challenge in terms of what's been going on with the City Hall Park, which is exactly next to the King County Courthouse to the south. There is an encampment there now. There have been some public safety issues in the area, as well as recently within the courthouse itself.
That's King County Councilmember Jeannie Cole Wells. She's referring to last week's attempted sexual assault of a county courthouse worker in the ladies' room by a homeless sex offender, allegedly, who cops say had hidden in a stall to lie in wait for the next woman who entered the bathroom in the middle of a weekday morning with security just outside. Mm.
Yeah, we've got to make some changes. And not only do we want our employees to be safe, and I'm saying we, any county employees who are there, but we also want the public to be safe. And people, jurors go into the building, people go in there for many different reasons. And everybody should be safe.
Now, one of the challenges in addressing the safety issues, crime, drugs, homeless with behavioral health issues and all of that that is around there is that particular area has always been that while the county owns the building itself, the city owns the park and the sidewalks, basically, which puts the city in charge of handling any security or public safety issues. And over the years, that's been a major problem.
We keep funding security on the part of the King County Sheriff's Office personnel for the park because there's really been no or very little security coming from the city of Seattle, from the police department.
And so now Cole Wells has a fresh idea.
It seems to me that something that could be a viable option would be to acquire City Hall Park from the city of Seattle. So that in that regard, we would operate it, we would maintain it, we would provide the public safety measures needed, and of course, as well, for the occupants of the encampment. We want to make sure that they get into shelter and have the services they needed that's in process now with the contract with the Public Defenders Association through their Just Care model. I'm very optimistic about seeing some real change.
She does not have a land parcel in mind just yet, but she says
acquiring City Hall Park for ourselves. Now, that could also open up some real possibilities for us in terms of future uses of the park. We have been studying for quite some time to improve the current county civic campus, which includes the courthouse and the Chinook building, the administration building, the King County Jail, and so forth. So this would provide us some additional footprint for our work in terms of what we're going to do for improvements for the whole civic campus.
So she hasn't introduced this legislation yet because she was waiting, trying to give time to Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan and County Executive Dal Constantine, who were working together on these kind of outreach efforts and coming up with these services and a way to clear out the encampment that's in the park in a very humane way. And the clock is ticking on that, basically, yeah. Is what Jeannie Colwell says. Look, we can't just let things go on as they are. You know, somebody was murdered in that park not too long back as well. There was a shooting, a couple of different shootings, I think, over the last couple of weeks there. And it's just too much. And I'll tell you, I personally have been doing stories. I can't even count how many years back I've been doing stories about the dangerous situations out there.
Yeah.
But I've been specifically talking to judges, Superior Court judges who are inside, their staff who have been accosted or made to feel unsafe as they walk from the train to the courthouse. There's been countless attacks on people right outside the courthouse. I think even the prosecutor was attacked once. And their jury, right? So it interferes with the justice system because the jurors don't feel safe coming there anymore. And now, after what happened last week, there is a large group of, I believe, mainly women who work at the courthouse who are planning a big event on Friday. They are mad. They have had it. They haven't felt safe for a long time. This, I think, went across the line.
Hannah, if people haven't felt safe in so long and the situation has been so bad for so long, what does SPD say if that technically is city land? I know the county owns the building, but if that's city land, why not a presence from SPD?
Anytime you have a shared property with the city of Seattle, it's like the homeless encampment was at the Seattle school property, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's always kind of a tug of war on who's going to do what. Also, though, at the city of Seattle, you have kind of a faster push towards the not necessarily locking so many people up and away from the jail kind of thing.
Right.
So that was what was going on a few years ago. Now, I think for a while there, things got bad a few years ago when I think it was a prosecutor or an attorney who was attacked right outside the courthouse, and they had some patrols, some cops on foot that were kind of walking around, extra patrols right across from that day shelter center that was is right across from the courthouse. But then I think it's that the pandemic, Jeannie Colwell and I were talking about that. I said, yeah. I remember that was happening, and now it's just not. And now since then, of course, we've got nearly 300 SPD officers gone, you know, vacant spots. So they don't have the staffing to do that right now is the answer.
It's time now for the Daily Dose of Kindness. It's sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. As we get closer to a new school year, a 7-year-old from Rhode Island has a message for kids who may be nervous about going back to class. Rowan Montgomery proves he is wise beyond his years, telling WLNE-TV.
Everyone is different and everybody's good in their own ways.
The incoming second grader posts inspirational videos for one reason alone.
When I make videos, it makes me feel happy that other people can watch them and feel happy.
Oh, I would say same for doing the Daily Dose of Kindness.
I do the Daily Dose of Kindness because it makes me happy, and I want other kids to feel happy.
See, it's not as cute coming from me. Rowan started making videos after he was bullied in school for his fuller-looking eyebrows, and he didn't want other kids to feel alone, so he decided to talk about what he went through.
Bullies, it doesn't matter what they think about you. It matters what you think about yourself, and it's good to embrace yourself and tell other people who you are.
How does he know this at 7?
It's amazing.
It took me decades to figure that out.
I still haven't.
Now his mom is helping him post even more videos from topics like COVID to back to school nerves to anxiety. He really covers it all.
Some people have anxiety and stuff, especially with this bad virus going on. It's like a tornado that's going to go right through your house.
He hopes his messages will remind other kids, and boy, I think adults too, that they're awesome in their own way.
Believe in yourself, that you can get through second grade and go through other grades. God knows how many grades there's going to be.
Oh my gosh, he's the cute. God knows how many grades there's going to be. It just goes on and on and on. Oh, I want to adopt him. Rowan, thank you for your insight and knowledge on just being awesome.
Yeah, that's sweet. I love that, Colleen. Thank you. And now, from the Gene Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, right here on Cairo Radio, it's G. Scott. Good morning, G.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
All right. So I'm going to get right into it. I'm going to sort of set this up, pull the string, and then let you go. Letitia James, she's the attorney general for the state of New York, laid out the case against her governor, Andrew Cuomo, yesterday, based on a review of 74,000 pieces of evidence and 179 interviews.
Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women, and in doing so violated federal and state law.
And Governor Andrew Cuomo's response?
I never touched anyone inappropriately or made inappropriate sexual advances.
And like Tone Loke says in the film Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, something ain't stirring the Kool-Aid, man.
It's 11 women. 11. Cuomo is basically saying all 11 women are lying, basically saying Letitia James is lying, basically saying that all of the testimony that they have, all of the evidence that they have, all of the interviews that they've done, everybody's lying. You know what my mom used to tell me? She used to say, baby, everybody ain't lying on you. That's when I would come in and be caught in a lie. That's what usually would happen. And in this case, he needed to resign months ago. When these allegations came out, he needs to resign right now. And this needs to happen. They need to come together. They need to make sure he resigns and or impeach him. We have a problem in this country, and we have a problem with deciding who we believe and who we don't. Yeah, sure. There's this thing about innocent until proven guilty. No doubt about it. Mm-hmm. In this case, this is about a person with a lot of power. And a lot of these people with power and influence, they've been able to get away with so much for so long. And it has to stop. If this continues, right, we are continuing to draw that line in the sand that says to women that are in power, that are in these situations. And by the way, when I look at Cuomo and I look at this situation, I don't know that man.
Right.
And I don't even know the women who are the alleged victims of this man. But when I look at that situation, I apply that situation to what we all see in our lives, in our communities, with our moms, mm-hmm. our daughters, our sisters, our aunts, and when they go to work and when they are in these positions. Do you believe your mama?
Right.
Do you believe your aunt? Nope. Who wants to go to work and be in these situations, and who wants to go to work and say, hey, I have a problem, and not be believed? And then it's you and 10 other people that have this same problem, and here this person says, I did not do anything. Then yesterday, I couldn't believe this. Yesterday, he puts out a video to show that he is affectionate person. And he shows him giving kisses and hugs to people to try to justify his actions.
I mean, that was Biden's excuse, too, right? That he's a touchy person. And
right.
It's like, okay, that has never been an excuse. I'm probably going to say something that surprises you guys. But I think until Bill Cosby is back in prison, Cuomo doesn't have to go anywhere. The precedent has been set.
You know what, Colleen? You're not wrong. You're not wrong. And here's why.
Well, it hurts so much to say it, but it's true.
Even though, and let me tell you what's even more powerful about your words that you just said. Because of today in 2021, because of news, right? Let's be real. We're talking about this right now. And today is Wednesday. On Monday, unless they do something, we probably won't even be talking about Cuomo. We'll be talking about something else that's in the news. And because news goes so fast, like you just brought up Bill Cosby, and I'm going to be honest with you, Colleen. I haven't thought about Bill Cosby in like a week and a half.
Right.
I haven't been able to stop thinking about him since I learned he was out of prison.
Yeah.
But the news is so fast. We got so many things that we're dealing with yeah. masks and vaccinations and COVID and eventually back to school. And
well, I'll place a bet then. I'll say if there are 11 women, and I'll say if the AG of New York said this is part of a pattern, there are more women out there who were too scared and may now come forward because of his denial. So just wait. We might get another headline as women.
Well, here's a question that we're going to bring up on the Gene Ursel Show later today, and I'll ask this to you. Colleen, in 6 months, is Cuomo still in office? Yes or no?
No, I don't think he's still in office. But again, I just think I'm going to put up a tough front here and just say, again, if we can let a convicted serial rapist, Bill Cosby, out of prison on a technicality, then Cuomo's may resign, but he's not going to lose his power.
Yeah, life's different when you're rich and powerful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's also different when you're rich and powerful and people decide to support you based on your politics.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that when you're in a situation like Cuomo, all your politics, whoever, that's out the door. That ain't had nothing to do with politics. That's a difference of right is right, wrong is wrong. And Cuomo in this situation is wrong.
Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah. You think he should be prosecuted? Think he should
absolutely.
Be charged?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Ain't no doubt. Mm-hmm. Wait, real quick. Would you or I get charged?
Yeah, right. 100%. 100%.
So yes. Yes, he needs to get charged. No doubt about it.
Yeah. Gee, I wish we could talk longer, man. I love talking to you, and I have so many things to say about this and what has to be one of the worst apologies I think I've ever seen. Accused of being touchy, and then he wheels out a slideshow of him being touchy with everyone, and he's like, "No, see, I do this all the time to everyone." Like, bruh,
is his brother Chris helping him out with apologies and statements? Come on, Chris!
Come on, Chris! Mad at all the Cuomos now,
Chris. Now you know Don Lemon. You gonna put him in a situation. Don Lemon gonna question y'all friendship. Chris, you gotta stop, Chris.
Oh, that is G. Scott, man. On the G and Ursula Show, 9 to noon, right after Seattle's Morning News, right here on Cairo Radio. Always good talking to you, G. Thanks, man. It is the day after primary day. The initial results came in just after 8 o'clock last night, and here to highlight some of those highlights is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron. Okay, so I want to revisit some of the biggies in Seattle. First, I want to start off over in King County, where the King County executive came out pretty strong. He, I believe, had 53% of the vote, and there was several people in that race, but really the only contender it looks like right now is State Senator Joe Wynn, who's right up there at around 30% of the vote. The executive, though, he told the West Seattle blog that he was feeling very confident last night.
Well, we're thrilled with the results. I mean, just about almost a 25% spread between me and my nearest opponent, and we got over 50%. He's got under 30%, so the strong showing that we've had shows that people, even in a time when there's a lot of discontent, when people are upset about COVID, homelessness, and other issues, that they understand that having someone in office who really is able to move the agenda, to take ideas and make them real, is important.
But Joe Wynn, the state senator who is likely going to be on the November ballot with him, he is also feeling very confident.
We have a lot of hope, and we're only seeing 17% of the ballots have come back in. So we know that more progressive, left-leaning folks are going to be coming in the next few days. So I think this is a very good spot to be in the first day. The lowest he's ever gotten has been like 60%. So the fact that he's even close to 50 should be concerning for him. And this is only the first day. And like November is a long ways away. There's a lot that can happen between now and then.
I think you'll see a lot of activity in this race moving toward the general election. I know Senator Wynn came into the legislature in like 2018. very fast and was like, I'm going to get stuff done. And he absolutely got stuff done. And that's kind of the path he's taking here. Critical of Dal Constantine for the homeless emergency that we haven't seen much as far as visible difference in until very recently. And Joe Wynn says that will be his top priority. Both of them actually shared their top priorities.
Well, we're thrilled with the results. I mean, just about almost...
But that's not it. Let me try that again. Here we go.
You know, clearly COVID is going to be the overarching concern from now until November. The Delta variant is surging. Infections and hospitalizations are up. That is something we've handled better than just about any jurisdiction in the country. But the issue that's on a lot of folks' minds is homelessness. And with our Health Through Housing initiative, we're bought over 800 units of housing, much more coming. We're going to have the ability to make a real, observable, substantive difference for people who are on the streets and for communities.
Oh, it's going to be alleviating homelessness, and we're going to do it as quick as possible because that is by far the most important issue facing our communities right now. And being able to address that, I think we have the solutions, we have the resources, we even have the people to do it. We just need to act with urgency to actually get it done.
At the city attorney, Seattle city attorney level, we have that three-way tie I was telling you about in the 6 o'clock hour. I'm just going to give you these numbers, okay? So we've got incumbent Pete Holmes, who was going for his fourth term in that office. He is in the middle. He's in second place at 27,844 votes. Right behind him is a progressive candidate, Nicole Thomas Kennedy, 27,288 votes. So rough, about 500 votes there. And then in the lead, we've got our right candidate, who is Ann Davison, who ran unsuccessfully for lieutenant governor, I believe, last year. She's at 29,401. So really...
Wow, very tight.
Super tight. So definitely going to want to watch that over the next few days. I think there's a risk, and I think observers that I heard last night also think there is a chance that Pete Holmes falls out in the primary, doesn't even make it to the November ballot.
Wow.
So.
Can I ask you about that, Hannah? This makes me think of two things. One, Ann Davidson being a more right-leaning candidate, and this being a Seattle City election, that seems generally unusual. Do you think it has to do with frustrations over the job Pete Holmes has been doing, because I hear a lot of people upset about people being, you know, the catch and release kind of stuff,
right,
being let back into the community?
There is a general sense that the Seattle City Attorney's Office doesn't really prosecute anyone, but Pete will tell you that he absolutely does when we're talking about a violent crime where there's no mental health involved and it's kind of a clear-cut thing. You know, you get into the weeds, but a lot of the times the folks that come through his office are people who are possibly going to be on involuntary treatment holds. They have to go through the whole process where they maybe end up at Western State, and then there's nowhere to go. There's no beds there, so it's a whole thing. That's kind of what I get when I've talked and gone into the deep look at what it is that they do. But there is that definite sense, yes, from the public that there's this lack of public safety effort just as a whole in Seattle, that, you know, in general, we don't really put anyone in jail. We've worked hard to let everyone out of jail. We're all about criminal justice reform. And in the meantime, business owners and communities are suffering and nobody cares about them.
What about the idea? What about turnout? Do you have any information on turnout? Because there were reports that it was pretty low in the 12-15% range. And then do people expect that sort of last minute surge from more left leaning voters?
Yes, definitely there is that, and that's pretty general. We saw, the last election where Shama Sawant was at the re-election,
right.
It was like nobody thought she was down, and then she came back from just way down,
right,
because everybody was cramming those things in the Capitol Hill drop boxes at the last minute. And I heard that, I think Joe Wynn told me that last night, that he saw it in his district, that there was all kinds of ballots that were stuffed full late last night, and he really is expecting to get a bump from that. I think you heard him say there. So I believe turnout were looking at about 21%. That's at the statewide level.
Okay.
And right about the same, I think, still in the King County area. I believe Kim Wyman, our Secretary of State, thought we would get to about 30% when all is said and done. So not a lot of wiggle room given the amount of ballots that have been returned so far.
Yeah.
But again, some of these races are very, very close and could come down to a couple of votes. I think probably what we know for sure is that Lorena Gonzalez and Bruce Harrell will be facing off in the upcoming November election for Seattle mayor. That is going to be an interesting race to watch. You've got Lorena Gonzalez, who is definitely the more progressive of the two and is, about worker protections, police reform in a big way, things of that nature, whereas Bruce is about adding some more cops, but also police reform. And he's very good at finding the middle. He doesn't go negative. He has a lot of support. I think it was 38% to 29%, so about 10 points over Lorena. And we'll see. We'll see if that holds up. He's good at getting out in the community. He's also got a pretty significant plan on guns. You know, we've heard a lot about gun violence. There is a sense among a lot of people that in all communities that the city council as a whole has promised to do a lot for gun violence and has done nothing. There have been efforts, but there's not, again, not a lot of visible difference there. Whereas Bruce Harrell has some specific plans about getting communities together and how to get those guns out of the hands of young people. So I think that will resonate with a lot of folks too.
It will be very interesting to watch. Keep us posted, won't you, Hannah?
You betcha.
That is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Mason in for Dave Ross. The word out of Afghanistan is that the Taliban is becoming more brazen in its attacks now that the U.S. withdrawal is all but complete. And it's been just over a month since the last time we checked in with CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, who joins us now. Good morning, Colonel.
Aaron, good morning to you, sir.
First of all, I imagine the situation in Afghanistan has not improved much. Is that correct?
That's a fair statement. In fact, you know, yesterday a Pentagon spokesman, when interviewed about the situation, kind of understated it when he said things aren't going well, and that's a quote. And we've seen the Taliban continue their offensive, continue to seize more and more districts throughout the country, now controlling well over half the country. And also now threatening a number of provincial capitals, such as Kandahar, Lashkargah, as well as Herat in the far west of the country.
Sir, can you, to help me get an idea, can you compare the Taliban forces and the Afghan forces? What do the two sides look like that we're talking about here?
Well, of course, the Taliban forces are not uniformed. They are very well armed. Highly mobile in terms of moving throughout the countryside in particular. And, of course, they have one enormous advantage, and that enormous advantage is they know where and when they're going to conduct their next attack, whereas the Afghan security forces, uniformed, in some cases perhaps more heavily armed in terms of artillery, obviously have some access to close air support, but that dwindling commodity is causing them enormous problems. But they have to be able to defend everywhere, and that is what has, I think, to a degree, has characterized a lot of the Afghan security problem. But, you know, Napoleon once said the moral is to physical as a 3:1, and war ultimately is a conflict of will. So it's the things perhaps you don't see that may be the most important. In this case, of course, the Taliban having confidence as they are being successful. And, of course, the morale of the Afghan security forces now suffering.
So we've pulled our troops out. Are we still conducting any kind of operations over there, airstrikes and such?
We have begun to conduct more airstrikes, particularly around those provincial capitals like Kandahar, I mentioned, that have been threatened by the Taliban. That has begun to accelerate over the last couple of days as the situation has deteriorated. By and large, the withdrawal, I think, is largely completed. We still have about 650 soldiers in Kabul to help secure the embassy, and a couple hundred more, it's believed, at the airport, bolstering defenses primarily provided by Turkey to maintain control of the Kabul International Airport, which obviously, as the Taliban controls more of the countryside, becomes a vital economic, political, and diplomatic lifeline.
I've been hearing about translators the Afghan translators and other allies over there who have helped us over the many years that this conflict has been going on. There's been an effort to get them out of the country because now they are targets for the Taliban. Can you first of all explain what those people, how they assisted us, what they did for us, and whether or not we are getting them out?
Right. These are primarily translators, drivers, staff people who provided vital assistance to the U.S. military during our 20 years in Afghanistan. And obviously now they are very threatened by their involvement with the U.S. should, in fact, the Taliban become successful. So the State Department has a special immigrant visa process for people in that particular category. They're allowed to process that. This is still a fairly arduous task, and obviously the individual has to make his way or her way to Kabul to our embassy, since the other consulates in the country are now closed down. The other thing that's going on in Afghanistan right now is a resurgence of the COVID pandemic to make things just a little bit worse. It's estimated the number of people that could potentially be involved are up to about 18,000 Afghans, and they're allowed to bring their family members with them, estimated about 50,000 or more. So overall, we could be talking of upwards of 70,000 Afghans that could be evacuated. And the first few hundred have arrived in the country using a staging point at Fort Lee, Virginia, for that process. Others who are at different stages in the immigration process may be moved to third countries, most notably countries either in the Persian Gulf or perhaps Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Central Asia, or the U.S. territory on Guam to finish their processing. But to give you a little comparison, Aaron, at the end of the Vietnam War, the United States accepted about 125,000 South Vietnamese who had similarly provided assistance to the United States during that war.
That is CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.